This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, March 25th, 2022. I'm Caleb Brown. As a developed world attempts to help other countries achieve higher levels of economic development, institutions of the developed world fail to effectively account for local culture and local institutions when they're delivering aid. Valuing people as agents of self-government as ends unto themselves is essential to that process. Matt Warner is co-author of Development with Dignity. We spoke earlier this month. We have a specific reason for bringing this up, but when we talk about foreign aid, when we talk about people living their best lives, what do we mean when we talk about dignity?
Well, I think what's useful about the term dignity, in addition to measures of economic success or even measures of freedom, which are obviously both very important, is dignity helps us understand that there is something about each individual that has value for the system. And that value is that no one knows better than the individual what their trade-offs are and what their preferences are and how they're going to, how those things are going to influence the way they behave. And so that data, if you're trying to solve for human flourishing, that data has to be accounted for in the model. So when we talk about human dignity, it helps us rethink traditional economic development approaches so that we are making sure we have a model that accommodates the individual agency of every person.
All right. So that seems hyper-local.
Yes, it is. And so this principle of you know, the usefulness of human dignity, in addition to its moral value, obviously respecting the right of every person to live their life as they choose, that's sort of, it's sufficient as a moral argument to support it. But in addition, this principle plays out in its practical use for finding solutions that actually stick. And so whether that has to do with the way a household functions or the ways that a community sets up rules for how to govern itself, all the way up to the level of a national government, the dignity of the individual as a starting principle helps us form processes that find, in an iterative sense, what the optimal solution is going to be.
So what has prevented that kind of iteration in foreign aid as we understand it today?
Yeah, well, the temptation is to have a sort of linear thinking about foreign aid. Some people have money, some people don't. Obviously, or it seems obvious that if we can just get that money to those people, or if we can spend that money on things that those people, we presume, that they need, then you solve some of these problems. But despite doing this for decades, we learned that that isn't how development works, that development is much more about the iterative interaction of individuals solving at that very individual level, which adds up to some aggregate change, a very sort of complex solution that no one person is able to centralize in their head and execute as a project design. And so traditional aid has been all about what do these outside experts think is going to solve the problem? Well, that already is not a winning formula, because the answer is within the system itself, and it emerges and expresses itself as people have agency, freedom, and the dignity afforded to be able to make choices for themselves.
You said spend the money on what these people, we presume these people need. And that just seems to go to the core of our misunderstanding of foreign aid more generally.
Absolutely. In fact, some of the interesting research that's now coming out under the broad umbrella of the topic of dignity is to try to look empirically at whether what we're providing in terms of development solutions matches what people themselves value. And so you have some research by Jeremy Shapiro, which goes and puts a cash value on the equivalent portion of some popular development solution and asks people which they'd rather have, the cash or the intervention. And even in cases where where they get the thing that they value, they prefer the cash, or they tend to prefer the cash anyway. And sometimes that can be used to support another popular idea in development, which is to just do cash transfer. That certainly has appeal as a comparison to alternatives that are much more paternalistic and thinking we know what people need. But what all of this really tells us is that it's very difficult, if not impossible, and also not really needed to try to figure out as outsiders what other people need. Much better to just get the system right, meaning create an environment, a set of rules that allow people to express their preferences and have the freedom to do so, so that they can attain what it is that they themselves feel like they need in real time. And the other interesting aspect is that as we've learned this, we've learned that, okay, getting the rules right, meaning, you know, the institutional framework can make a big difference. Even that is not something that outsiders should take too strong of a leadership role on, because the nature of strong, sticky institutional change, getting the rules right in context for that place, is also something that should reflect the choices and preferences of the people who will be governed by those changes.
You and I have talked about this a number of times, the outsider mentality when it comes to foreign aid and promoting development in some of the more impoverished places on Earth. What have been if we had to evaluate costs and benefits as broadly as we can, what would you say are the costs and benefits of the current approach, which is drop the things into these communities, into these countries that we think they need, whether or not that's what they actually would prefer?
Well, one of the tempting things as the development community has gotten smarter about moving away from things like, okay, it's just capital infusion. People need capital. No, it's more complicated than that. Well, they need good institutions. Well, then we've learned that if we bring institutions as though they're these things that can be taken from one place and copycatted somewhere else, that also is a denial of the dignity of the people to choose the systems that will govern them. And in a practical sense, it's also a denial of the utility of idiosyncratic institutional frameworks that will function best there. And so the reason why this is important as today we think about getting the institutions right, our book includes, my co-author Tom Palmer and I, update some of the data on this debate and development between autocracy and democracy. And what the data show is if you're a betting person and you want human flourishing, you better choose democracy over autocracy. And the reason why that matters is that getting the rules right is not so simple as saying, well, if I were king for a day and I know that liberal democracy is the best way to ensure human rights and human flourishing, then I'll come in as king for a day and I'll set all the rules and I'll make sure that you have the right kind of system. Well, that is on its face at odds with liberal democracy. And so this is a really important debate, because even people who care about liberal democracy fall for the idea that those who champion liberal democracy have enough knowledge to come in and establish it on behalf of others, and you don't. And the reason is the dignity of the individual helps us see that there is knowledge, real knowledge. It might be tacit, it might be, folk knowledge, whatever. But the people have knowledge about what they themselves care about and what they will do. And so the most choice-based ideology on the planet, liberal democracy, ought to be introduced in a choice-based fashion. Not just, again, the moral reason is sufficient, but in addition, the practical reason is it's not going to stick and it's not going to work. And so what you get is a resentment of liberal democracy, a rejection, because the form that they've experienced it has been a foreign imposition. And so what we argue for in our book is that, yes, liberal democracy represents as a general set of principles, the right kinds of ideas for setting up institutions. But the form they take and from what starting point, that's the business of the people who are going to be governed by those institutional changes.
Right. It seems like broadly what you're talking about across this entire conversation is buy-in.
Well, it's buy-in, but it's also it's also decision-making power. So I can go to a country and say, hey, I've studied the property rights system of Denmark. It works pretty well. You might be able to use it well here. What do you think? Should I come bring it to you? And you'll have these cooperative exercises where national governments, the land ministry, will cooperate and buy into the idea that this outsider system is going to work. And by all means, we should absolutely be accelerating the exchange and sharing of different examples of institutions. The globalization of ideas has been super important. But the prerogative of deciding what to take from foreign ideas, how to adapt them in for purpose, and to have that be collaborative in the whatever the proper manner is in that setting, it sounds vague and tricky, and a little bit it is, but we have no choice because that is how good institutions form and stick.
So where have we seen this, backlash against liberalism broadly in some particular circumstance?
Well, if you look at Freedom House, the democratic norms have been declining around the world for 15 years. This is very alarming. Even prior to the horrific decision by Putin to invade Ukraine, we were worried about some of the rise of authoritarian populism and some of the rotten fruits that come from that across Europe and in other places, and in the United States. And one of the things that we now see how clearly what that does is when you centralize power in the name of being against something else, you leave yourself extremely open to the whims of that power. And you can imagine more democratic systems and more checks and balances that would make it much more difficult to make these kinds of horrific humanitarian crisis producing decisions. Not perfectly. Nobody pretends. And this is the important lesson for those of us like myself who've grown up in strong liberal democracies. I think some of the mistakes we've made is thinking that our relatively high-performing liberal democracies are the ideal. No, they are versions of attempts to discover, based on a set of principles, some ideals around the ideas of liberal democracy. And so they're versions of it. And when we make the mistake of saying this is the only way to do it, and not only that, we know how to install it, we're setting ourselves up for ruining the brand of liberal democracy because we're not going to be able to deliver. Much better to listen to, share with, and work alongside those who will be governed by institutional changes towards liberal democracy. And a specific example that encourages me on this is the think tank in India, Center for Civil Society, collaborated with street vendors to develop collaboratively a solution to their illegality. They were kept out of the formal sector. They developed a new law that institutionalized street vendors and gave them voice within local town councils where they had the ability to solve some of the natural issues that come up, like where could street vendors work and, you know, at what times, et cetera. And they could participate in that system. And that's an example of institutional change that was inspired by the principles of dignity and human freedom, but was expressed very much as a function of local voices.
Matt Warner is co-author of Development with Dignity. He's also president of the Atlas Network. Subscribe to and give a rating to the Cato Daily Podcast on your podcast platform of choice, and follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.